teaches people that they can have that connection and have fun and be doing those things while they're in sobriety. You can't do this alone. You can't do it alone. It really is, the healing comes from that community, and we teach and really foster that community here so that clients can be successful. When we're talking about that holistic approach, we don't want to be adding another substance or a chemical in somebody's body if they don't need it.
Ben Esra Çavuşoğlu. 18 yıldır ayık bir hayat yaşıyorum. Bağımlılık hastalığıyla mücadelem, beni beden ve zihin performansımı iyileştirmek, hayat kalitemi arttırmak, daha sağlıklı ve uzun yaşamak için yeni yöntemler, cihazlar ve takviye ürünler araştırmaya yönlendirdi. Bağımlılık hastalığı, biohacking ve longevity alanlarındaki kendi deneyimlerimden, dünyadaki son gelişmelere, çığır açan girişimcilerden uzman akademisyenlere, yıllardır yaptığım sohbetler artık her hafta Ayık Kafa Podcast'te. Welcome, Rainey.
Thank you, Ezra. Nice to be here.
I want to lay the ground first to start with. I'm a person who is living a long-term recovery. What it means is I do not use alcohol or drugs since 2006. And that was only possible because of the journey I went through. Today's discussion with you, what I want to make is to talk about the importance of a long-term inpatient rehab facility.
Yeah.
Because yet again, I want to share with my audience that up until I went to long-term residential treatment, I've been probably in 4 different places. Some of them were for 15 days. The longest were for a month. Okay. And somehow I didn't grasp the idea of what recovery means, what's going on inside, and what do I need to learn how to stay sober? Obviously, this is a topic near and dear to my heart.
Yeah.
And it's a pleasure to discuss it with you because you're the clinical director of Altamira.
Mm-hmm.
You have a PhD in clinical psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And the specialty of Altamira is also, it's a dual diagnosis program, which actually many places says that they're dual diagnosis. But unfortunately, they're not really putting the emphasis on the co-occurring disorder. They're great on treating addiction.
Yeah.
But when it comes to treat the primary, most of the time, diagnosis that they fail, therefore sustaining a long-term recovery, sometimes it's very hard for the patient. So
yeah.
I just wanted to make an opening statement like that so everybody would understand where we're going with. Let's get to know you a little bit.
Okay. I've been with Altamira for 5.5 years now. And I came on here as a primary therapist in 2018 and was promoted last year to the clinical director. We are a 90-day residential treatment program, and we do specialize in dual diagnosis clients. So for clients that come in here, they need to have a substance use disorder, a primary substance use disorder. But what we found, Ezra, is that probably 90% plus of our clients have an underlying co-occurring disorder, be that trauma, depression, anxiety, things like that, that are actually sort of motivating and sustaining the substance use disorder. And what I would say, you know, initially to your introduction, that some of the places that are dealing with just substance use disorders, I actually think that those aren't very effective. And by that, I mean that until individuals can really understand what is motivating and driving the substance use disorder, it is very hard for long-term stability and recovery. And so what we specialize in is not just substance use disorders, but really diving deep into the underlying causes, what is causing individuals to reach for that drink, to reach for the pills, to reach for things that are, you know, in the initial moment seem like effective coping strategies, but as you know, over time are incredibly ineffective and cause, you know, a lot of issues in relationships and family and jobs, employment. And for a lot of our clients, they come to us really having hit their bottom and not really understanding the roots of their addiction.
Is there always a co-occurring disorder?
My philosophy is yes. Even if it is not an official diagnosis that you might find in the DSM, I believe that for a lot of us, that if your addiction has come to a point where it's causing enough problems that you're coming here to Altamira, I would suggest that there is an underlying problem. For some clients, it is, you know, they're going through a divorce or they have had a death of a parent. So there is usually one, some sort of external stressor that's going on in their lives that's precipitating that increase in the substance use, the substance of choice. And for a lot of people, they've gone their whole lives without any issues with alcohol. And then something happens in their lives that causes the stress and enough disruption in their day-to-day life that they increase and increase, leading them to needing the level of care that we offer.
Mm-hmm. So I do know that prior to Altamira, you were doing more of...
Yeah, community mental health.
Community mental health. In Turkey, the government actually, it's really doing a great job on supporting people who are not able to afford a residential rehab.
Okay.
And their reach out points, first step, they call it, some sort of an outpatient. There are a couple of long-term residential program. But the reason I wanted to talk to you, because first of all, you know the difference between the community mental health program versus a residential program that I would call only mostly upscale people can afford it.
Right, right.
Which unfortunately in Turkey, we're struggling with the fact that there are not any, actually, I can easily say, mostly I try to use some round words, but this is a fact. Unfortunately, in Turkey, we do not have residential program for people who can go there, for people who has a certain type of an education, owning businesses, still are a productive member of society. Therefore, knowing the difference, what's the best way to approach these people who are actually sometimes their intellect, their money, their family can be an obstacle rather than when you say, because I heard you said that hit rock bottom, it's so different than hitting the rock bottom from someone who is homeless out there or needing financial support from the government versus rock bottom in still in your own wealth and family. Can you please a little bit give explanation on that?
No, absolutely. I think for a lot of, first of all, there's the stigma that's connected to addiction. And for a lot of people that we treat, you know, that come from, you know, wealthier families or are in higher positions, there's always the risk of losing their position if people find out about the addiction. So there's a lot of privacy issues and confidentiality issues that people worry about. The other component that you addressed, Ezra, is the idea that a lot of times the family system and the money can be a protective device from preventing clients from hitting that rock bottom sooner. So the addiction is unfortunately then sustained sometimes across decades because there's the family system and the money that steps in to prevent that rock bottom. These people can still be housed and they still can afford to pay for their drug of choice or their alcohol. So all these things that end up enabling and sustaining the addiction actually do not work in their favor. The interesting part for us is, and for me, coming from community mental health, where, you know, the system is really strained, you know, any given case manager or social worker or therapist is dealing with a caseload of 25 to 30. At Altamira, each individual therapist, their caseload is 4 individuals, which affords these people to come in and really do that intensive dive into the treatment and get a lot more out of it. I also think that for certain clients, the idea of taking time, you know, 3 months, our program is 90 days, and the thought of taking 90 days away from their lives, stepping away from a board, stepping away from as a CEO position, stepping away from families is really complicated when you run in these circles that there is a lot of judgment and a lot hanging on sort of how you present to the world.
I assume that it's much more difficult to make them understand that they need to. And in a way, they need to humble themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
What are the tools that you guys are using for that? Because it's the hardest type of clientele. Like you explained.
Yeah. You know, we talk about entitlement a lot and the entitlement of clients coming in. It's very difficult for clients that we serve to come in who most of their lives have never been told no. They've never had things like electronics taken away for a few days when they come in. So there are all these things that are very unusual, this level of clientele that we treat. That's a difficult intersection when they first come in. What I will say is when clients come in, and they are able to sort of surrender and start to learn and understand about addiction as a disease and also about the underlying forces that are sustaining the disease, they're able to really step in and utilize those skills that we teach. And if they're willing to stay for the full 90 days, the results are phenomenal at what can happen and how it can really alter and change their lives for the better. many of our clients come in and they even say, oh, I don't have a problem. You know, it's gotten a little out of hand, but it's really not a problem. So what we really do is, you know, focus on helping the client understand the data, helping them understand what's happening physiologically in their brains. And also the community here in and of itself helps alter those perceptions, those false perceptions that a lot of clients have about addiction or about the level of their distress or problem.
Let's dive in a little bit the difference of a short-term treatment versus a long-term treatment. Because as I mentioned at the beginning, it really did help me. I was, to begin with, understand the idea of the disease of addiction, and then slowly understood that actually long-term programs are almost having a brain workout. Wake up at the same time every morning, going to the breakfast, whether you want it or not. This is obviously, I'm simplifying the program, even that, to rewiring the brain, it made a huge difference on me. But, you know, I would like your take on it.
Yeah, definitely. I think what you're referring to is the idea of the healing of the brain. And what we've discovered is that for clients that have that level of severe alcohol use disorder or severe methamphetamine use disorder or opioid use disorder, it takes a year plus for the brain to fully heal. So our clients come in, and a lot of clients come in and say, listen, I'm going to get everything done in 2 weeks. I'm going to work really hard. We have a lot of type A, very successful people that think they can get it all done in 2 weeks or get it all done in 30 days. And unfortunately, what you're referring to is that you can't outpace time. Time is just what's needed in order for the brain to heal and in order for those neural pathways to develop different, you know, skills so that the client can use different skills when they step out. We are a 90-day program, Ezra, but we will take clients for 30 days minimum. And the reason for that is what we've come to understand is it's very hard for a lot of people to sort of digest the concept of taking 3 months out of their lives. And what happens in most cases, and we have a pretty high success rate of that, is clients that commit to a 30-day length of stay will land in treatment, start to see and feel and realize the benefits of treatment, and then extend on their own. We talk about our program, the first 30 days, we actually call just detox and stabilization. We actually really don't consider the treatment starting until day 30. Because for so many of our clients, just coming in, going through detox, clearing the substances out of their system, getting their brains clear enough to be able to even integrate the skills that they're using just takes time. So we call that first month detox and stabilization. And only at 30 days plus do we start offering the more intensive workshops in trauma or grief and loss and all these sort of more deeper dives that the clients do. We don't want to sort of, it's contraindicated to start opening those things up when the clients haven't even cleared from their substance abuse. Yeah.
You made a new description of a 1 month rehab now. You change it to a detox and stabilization.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, great. I believe that.
Yeah. And the other component I would speak to is, you know, we do for everybody, we do intensive neuropsychological testing. And what we want to make sure is that if we do that testing too soon in the treatment episode, the clients may not have cleared from their substance, and therefore there's noise in the data. The results that we would be getting are not going to be accurate or useful for the client moving forward. The longer we can wait to start the testing, the more we allow the brain to heal, and then those results are going to be a lot more accurate and a lot more predictive of supporting the client outside of treatment, if that makes sense.
Can you walk me through about from, let's say, from day one until the 90th day, what's the journey of a client normally?
Yeah. So the client comes in and that first, they're going to be on our detox stabilization level where they have 24/7 access to the nurses on that floor and the doctors on that floor for at minimum the first 3 days. So the first 72 hours, no matter where clients are in their detox process. Some clients have come in and they have stopped the substance of use for a little while. Others are using literally up until the point that they walk through the doors. After that, we in that first week, they're meeting with an addiction psychiatrist for an intake evaluation. Mm-hmm. That's usually about 2 hours. They're meeting with our MD or doctor on site for about 2 hours. They're starting with a neuropsych team, getting their psychosocial evaluation and just slowly starting to integrate into the community. After that, the clients are really starting into the daily group programming, which we offer on any given day. They're going to be doing groups from 9, at 9, at 1, and at 4. And the times in between are when they're doing the individual therapy, neuropsych testing, We do offer sort of massage and acupuncture and yoga, things that are for, we have a very strong belief in sort of the holistic approach to treatment. Mm-hmm. It's not just about the mind and the brain, it's about the body. So our chef here also specializes in, you know, foods that are going to be healing and best supportive in recovery. So we really look at the whole person, not just what is going on in their brains and from the addiction standpoint. Once they move through that first month where they're going to be starting to set, you know, real goals with their individual therapist, they really dive in 3 times a week to whatever the underlying issues are. We also integrate the family system as much as we can, Ezra. And as you know,
I'm going to come into that, but I want to just shine light on the dietary knowledge, let's say, because I think that not only because they have the money to afford, but also when someone is in active addiction, they're really having a malnutrition. They're deficient in their supplements and their lifestyles, the habitual things like you need to sit down and eat. I think it's also the reason you guys are using a holistic approach.
Absolutely. And all of our clients meet with a nutritionist when they come in so that they can really better understand individually what's been going on for them, how they've been eating, what their eating patterns are. And then they get sort of a layout, so to speak, of what to focus on while they're here in terms of eating. We also talk about movement to moving the body. And that doesn't even have to be intensive exercise, but some form of the body in motion also is that behavioral activation component that, you know, we talk about the phrase mood follows action. And again, we believe in that too. It's not just about intellectually understanding what's going on. The idea that when we move our bodies, we change our internal physiology and that all of those things are going to benefit the client. And once, if the client agrees to sort of be here those 3 months, those habits in terms of eating and movement and exercise and therapy and practicing the skills get really solidified over that time. When clients are only here for a month, sometimes they can be okay. I mean, there's no predictor that a client that's here 30 days is not going to be successful, but it dramatically decreases the chances over time of them maintaining the success because they're not, they might be learning the skills, but they're not practicing the skills in a protected environment. Therefore, when they step out to the stressors of their daily life that have reinforced and sometimes even caused the increase in substance use, those things are just going to come back into their lives and not set them up for success.
And I do know that you guys also weekend trips into local areas in order to show people that they can have fun still while they're in recovery.
100%. So yeah, our clients twice a week, we have an experiential program manager and we joke that he's got the best job in the program because he gets to go sailing and horseback riding and kayaking and hiking and doing all these things outdoors and getting outdoors and moving that actually, again, teaches people that they can have that connection and have fun and be doing those things while they're in sobriety. The other thing I love about our program is once clients cross that sort of 30-day threshold or complete what we call phase one, they can do one-to-one experiential activities with Nico, meaning let's say a client comes in and they have been, you know, they're an avid golf player and they've been, but golf for them means drinking, you know, across 18 holes of golf. Nico can take them out and go golfing and practice again, going back what we call exposure therapy, as you know, to go to the places and practice the skills, you know, outside of treatment while they're still able to come back to the residential level of care that can teach them learning new skills and that they can actually accomplish this and have some successes before they step out. We've even had clients go to, you know, basketball games or baseball games, sporting events, all of these places that historically a client might have been using and using heavily, again, as that exposure component to help teach them and help them understand that they can, A, enjoy it without the substances, but also get through it and recognize that their lives don't have to change completely. They just have to be thoughtful about what changes to put in place.
Rainey, let's talk a little bit because it was very interesting when I was experiencing and aside of the therapy, your neuropsych testing, and it kind of continues for a whole 3 months almost. Mm-hmm, yeah. And you guys are, what I experienced with you guys, not obviously me, through clients, you want to first understand if the person really have that secondary disorder.
Yes.
Or is it just substance induced. So can you walk me through a little bit that journey? because it's very important. Because over here, you know, I know what it is, obviously. Yeah. What we see here in Turkey, also many parts of Europe as well. I don't want to just say, oh, Turkey doesn't do a good job. What I see is that the interaction of some medication which are prescribed with the substance or with the disorder, it's really not making the person possible to stay sober, such as I can give examples. Recently, some young women reached out to me and she wanted to be my client. When I asked what her drug of choice, it was cocaine. Then she was like, you know, I have ADD and bipolar disorder. I said, okay, treated, yeah. And then she started giving me the names of the medications that is prescribed to her. And one of it was Ritalin. I said, like, it's quite impossible for you to stay without the other substance because, you know what? It's almost like you're trying to push the brake pedal and the gas pedal at the same time. So what I really like with your center and a few other centers, obviously, in the United States, the number one rule in a way is that what can this person consume, take for the rest of their lives, which is very, if they need to take a medication, it's very carefully chosen in order not to create a problem in the long term.
Exactly.
The second, what I watch you guys doing is like you really are trying to not diagnose the person day one and you wait for a while. And I would like to hear a little bit more about this.
You know, when a client comes in, we will start with what we call our working diagnoses. A lot of clients come in that have a laundry list of medications. And our philosophy is we don't want to medicate something that is not present. For instance, a client might be coming in on antidepressants. We don't really know at that point what their baseline is, and we don't know what's really going. Clients will come in too that might have been given sort of a mood stabilizer medication, whether that be for bipolar or another disorder. Again, a lot of times that medication might not be either treating the problem because it's the wrong medication, or actually that client might not actually have that underlying problem, but yet taking the medication. And our addiction psychiatrists really want to take that approach of simplifying the medication regimen if we can. So what we do right out of the gate with most of our clients is we do genetic testing. We take a saliva swab and we send it away. And that gives us a blueprint of what medications are likely to actually integrate more effectively given that client's specific DNA. So maybe that client does need an antidepressant, but they've been on the wrong antidepressant for 10 years. So we're initially looking at what is the client coming in? What are the complaints? It's really important for us that the clients are part of this process, that they're part of the conversation, and that it feels like a collaborative thing for them to be part of their treatment and part of the choices around their medications. Clearly, when clients come in on a lot of what we call central nervous system depressants, CNS depressants, such as benzodiazepines and other medications, a lot of times those can be really damaging over the long term, and they're not really helping clients deal with the underlying anxiety or symptoms that are coming up. So there's that medication component where, again, those initial conversations are, you know, how long have you been on these medications? What were you originally prescribed these medications for? And again, another one of the benefits of staying longer in treatment is that over 3 months, we can do a lot of work on tapering off of medications that we might have a hypothesis that are not effective for that client, and then having the added benefit of adding a new medication and seeing how that is effective for that particular client. As far as the neuropsych testing, everybody that comes in gets our standard battery, which is the psychosocial assessment. We do a personality testing. Again, all these appointments are about 3 hours in length. And then we do sort of a cognitive assessment. And what we look at from this data is almost the intersection between the personality, the characterological traits of that client, intersection with how their brain thinks, their cognition, their style of thinking, to be able to better understand how they have been navigating the world, and also to better understand how they can improve navigating the world when they leave. If clients are here longer than 30 days, that's when we can do a deeper dive with a neuropsych testing. You mentioned ADD, ADHD. We have a lot of clients coming in that have actually not been formally tested for ADD or ADHD.
I was just going to come into that because this program, as you know, Soberhead, the English translation, is to educate people in a way. There are certain drugs actually mimicking certain diagnoses, such as like if you're an alcoholic, if the doctor doesn't know what's going on in your life or not educated enough about the disease of addiction, they may easily diagnose you with depression.
Yes, exactly.
Without having it. Can you give a couple of examples like that so people would have a better understanding what can mimic what and why it's important?
Yeah, what we found too is that a lot of times with clients, and what you're referring to, Ezra, is clients tend to want to self-medicate. And when they don't have a prescription, if they're not on an antidepressant, there's a higher likelihood that they're going to reach for something like alcohol or another sort of mood-altering substance that's going to make them temporarily feel better. What we found for people that use more amphetamine-type medications like Ritalin or Vyvanse or these other ones that are prescription, a lot of times clients that are not prescribed that truly have ADD, ADHD, are reaching for other substances like cocaine or amphetamines. Because actually those substances are helping regulate that client, because in essence, all the prescription medications are forms of amphetamines that are more accurately dosed for those symptoms. Now, we see a lot of clients coming in that are misdiagnosed with ADD, ADHD, mm-hmm. because there's, again, in this system of privilege in terms of the population that we treat, there's a lot of pressure. So we treat a lot of young adults that have gone through parents who are actually pushing for their kids, their children, to have these diagnoses so they can get these medications so that they can study longer and harder and be more successful. Well, the message that gives to the client and that young adult is that they need these in order to be successful, which then a lot of times precipitates an addiction. We have a lot of clients now coming in specifically with an addiction to Adderall. Specifically mm-hmm. with addiction to some of these medications that they've been taking that unfortunately are not based on really the science and the data from the neuropsych testing. And so what we can do when they come into treatment is we can actually take them off. And most clients that come in on ADD, ADHD medications, we will take them off of that medication in order to get them back to baseline. So then we can test or retest. A lot of times it's testing initially because they've never had the test, so that we can really determine whether they have an underlying attention deficit or not. I would say most of the time they do not, and that they have been self-medicating and taking these medications that are highly addictive from pressures of the family system, pressures of the job, pressures of college, pressures of achievement and overachievement. And so many of our clients at Altamira have these pressures of that, you know, whether it's living up to a parent who is super successful or a successful person in their own right, trying to maintain that. And the sad part about it is they're reaching for these external things to alter their insides, alter their brains, which they fundamentally don't need to do given the right skills and the right time.
So we can say then everything that you're explaining, and it's my also belief, that you keep saying the word baseline, and I want to open that up, meaning like when the person doesn't have the substance, mm-hmm. nor the medication.
Yeah.
And it takes a little while until the brain really detox it. Actually, you know, it takes a lot of time, but, you know, at least you will get the idea within a month, almost, if not 2 months, that what's actually the symptoms or the thinking pattern most of the time. And if the person have a diagnosis, and if there is, what's that diagnosis? So that's very important. So which tells me that a long-term residential program is super, super important, because you cannot decide in 1 month, expect the person to clear their head from the drugs.
Yeah.
And at the same time, go to the baseline and to see if that person has another diagnosis that may be jeopardizing their sobriety if it's not taken care of.
Exactly. Exactly. And so many of our clients, you know, we're seeing that there is so much underlying trauma. And I think there's a misconception in the population and the demographic that we treat, that because there is access to means and access to money and access to treatment, mm-hmm. that therefore there must not be any trauma. And really what I've learned from going from community mental health to this population is that there really is no difference in the amount of trauma that these people have experienced. It's a different kind in terms of where they are and where they live, but there's so much trauma underneath it. Interesting thing about the medications that I really love about our philosophy is that it can be really damaging long-term to take some of these medications, especially some of the mood stabilizers, especially some of the antipsychotic medications. And we don't want to, when we're talking about that holistic approach, We don't want to be adding another substance or a chemical in somebody's body if they don't need it. Again, to your point, Ezra, that benefit of that longer term in treatment is it allows us, it affords us the opportunity to truly understand what is happening for this client. Because a lot of times clients have been on these medications for decades and they're not even sure initially. Some of the clients aren't even sure why they went on it. It's just, this is what I take and this is what I do. And what we can do is so many times our clients come to us again with that laundry list of medications. And when they leave us, it is refined. It is really down to the minimal amount of what they need specific to the symptoms that they're suffering from. A lot of times somebody might have been suffering from a major depressive disorder or some other adjustment disorder earlier on, but 10 years later, they might not be. Well, then there's no need for them to be taking those medications if the symptoms aren't there.
We discussed the medication and the co-occurring disorder. Let's now talk a little bit about the importance of these group therapies, why also it's important to have a long-term residential program, because in a way that 1 month, what I observe through my clients, through myself, and also the treatment center we built in Antep started with street kids. When it's a short-term stay, this bond doesn't happen. Therefore, to be able to open themselves up, especially through a privileged community, that the thought and the belief that constantly it's been reminded to them since they're a child, keep the secret, don't share your weaknesses. So there is a resistance in a way, whether you're poor or rich, but it puts much more pressure when you come from a demographics that you're concerned that if you open up yourself, and the word may go out. So it takes a while to trust your peers over there. And also, I guess, from the therapist's eyes. So give me a little bit the changes, the journey that these people go through.
There's so much shame connected to addiction. And there's so much shame in this idea of being not good enough or a failure. And the idea of most of these clients have carried that burden and they carried the weight of that shame for years. And they have been in isolation and their substance use disorders predominantly have been secretive and behind closed doors. And the power of what you're talking about, the community and being able to come to a safe place where there are like-minded people that come from the same demographics as they do, and to be able to step into that space and start to open up and start to share and start to the power of vulnerability, to be able to just take a breath and step in and understand that there are so many more commonalities and similarities between them and the other people surrounding them than differences. There is such healing in that, Ezra. And so many of our clients come in and the healing, the main healing component, independent of our therapists who are phenomenal and the neuropsych and the groups and the programming, it's the other clients that to me have the most profound effect because they get very close. They recognize that we encourage clients to share their stories. It's one of the first assignments within that first week, after that first week, which seems terrifying to people.
Yeah, I was just going to say that should be really difficult.
Really difficult. But once they do, and then they recognize that the support and the feedback, it just takes down a lot of these barriers and these things that have gotten in the way, and then the healing can take place. So there's the healing that happens here within the community and the bonds that are made and the meaningful connections that are made independent of substances. And that is so important because so many of our clients, the only way they felt they have been able to access intimacy and vulnerability and connection is through their substance of choice. And they come to Altamira, they can start to do that differently. That also is part of why we integrate some sort of what we call fellowship groups or meetings. So we are not necessarily an AA program, but we would be remiss not to offer our clients all these different forms of fellowship meetings, whether it's AA, whether it's NA, whether it's Dharma recovery, whether it's Smart recovery, whether it's Life Ring. There are a lot of different ways. And the idea is you can't do this alone. You can't do it alone. It really is the healing comes from that community. And we teach and really foster that community here so that clients can be successful and know that the connections they've made in treatment, they are able to do that outside of treatment as well. They learn that here.
I was going to come to that, but a very, very crucial part is also the family program because you can treat the person. If that person goes back to their family, whether their spouse, their parents or to their children.
Yeah.
Even we can consider as a family the business partners.
Yeah.
If they're not aware of this phenomena of the disease of addiction, how to set boundaries or support the patient, it's really tough. But there's a huge benefit of a family program. I know why, but maybe you want to share that, because I don't want to be the person who's sharing my knowledge here. And if there are things that it's still in my mind, I would add. But first of all, tell me, in what part of the treatment you guys start to the family program?
We start right away with client's permission. So if a client is willing, what we encourage is to allow sort of release of information so that the individual therapist is able to communicate right out of the gate to the spouse, to the partner, to the parent, to the family system, because a lot of times that collateral information is so important to afford us that bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And most clients are surprisingly sort of willing to do that out of the gate.
But hold on, I have to make a joke here. Families are happy because the person is inside and they can complain as much as they can to the therapist. Uh-huh. So they have a vent out place.
Exactly.
And the client is in a safe place. They don't face the family. So it's a really good combination.
Someone who
experienced it, I can easily say that.
Well, and really, a lot of these family systems, Ezra, they've been through their own degree of trauma connected to their loved one's addiction. So we can immediately offer that support. And what we do is we can offer referrals and recommendations for the family, again, right out of the gate, for therapy, for intensive case management, for family therapy to support them so that while the client's in treatment, they too are learning the skills and better understanding what's going on so that when the client comes out, they can support it. If we treat the client in a vacuum without integration into the family system at all, the likelihood that that client is going to relapse and the family system not being able to understand all those different dimensions of addiction and recovery, we'd be setting that person up for failure. So what we do is our family program, the family work happens right away with the individual therapist reaching out to the family and supporting them and giving them referrals. But the family program happens once a month. So even if the client is here for 30 days, they have that opportunity to do the family program. It's across 3 days. It's very supportive. What the research has suggested is that old school confrontational, you know, put the identified patient in the middle of the circle and let the family system rail at them. That is not effective. It really is more effective, that sort of connection and understanding and psychoeducation around it. So our family program facilitator is unbelievable. And she really is well-versed in sort of experiential types of therapies to sort of get people out of their heads and sort of more into their bodies and doing experiential things to help understand addiction. If a client comes in, let's say, and is only here for 30 days, and a family program happens to be within that first week, which would be too soon for them to jump immediately into it, we offer that they can always come back. So our family program is open later, so that if that client does decide to discharge at 30 days, they can still come to the next family program in that month. I have a client right now, Ezra, who's here for the full 90-day program. And he did the first family program he did with his parents. The second month, he did the family program with his spouse. And then just next week, he's going to do the third family program with his siblings. So a lot of times, if you're here for the 90 days, again, it affords a more sort of integrated and individualized type of family program that you can have different sets of your family come into it. Because what we know and what you're referring to is without that family system support, without the family understanding the disease, it's a family disease. And not only do they need to help understand the addiction, they need to be supported.
With a couple of clients of mine, I experienced that, you know, obviously there's a fear and anger a lot between like the families to the client to the family at the same time. And there's a super miscommunication. And due to the language problems, I had to be in the middle. I was the translator and I was facilitating the family program with the center. Interestingly enough, being able to see that changes and being able to help, whether to the mother or to the father or the center is helping to their daughter, let's say. And then at the end, seeing that unity, getting together and understanding that, oh my God, all these years I had this very, very wrong idea. or blaming each other. Yeah, the communication cut off like from the get-go when this person starts using. So I think that our goal when we do the family program to create that recommunication so that they can continue to their life as supportive human beings in a way.
100%. And, you know, the way I spoke to the clients connecting and understanding that they've been through a lot of the same experiences with other clients, in the same vein, the family systems coming together, usually we have 5 or 6 different family systems that are connecting in the program. We do some of the work with just the families without the clients in the room, and they can have that same experience of, oh my gosh, I'm not alone. Oh my gosh, I've shared that with you and I understand. And really what you're speaking to, the healing that we've seen in the family system for me have been one of the most profound and moving parts of the healing and the recovery and treatment is watching this family system that has been so fractured due to miscommunication and misunderstanding, and to be able to bring that system together. You know, we talk about clients coming to treatment, the impact of that across all of the different family members can be so profound that their individual healing is not just, again, here. It has shockwaves across the whole family that they can heal as well. It's pretty amazing to watch.
Obviously, aftercare is super important.
Yeah.
It's 90 days is, okay, you're in a safe place.
Yeah.
You have a bunch of staff around you, whether psychiatrist or neuroscientist or therapist.
Yeah.
But now you're outside in the world.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah. So we actually talk about that right in the first week. We're already starting to talk about what we call continuing care. We actually have a staff member that his job is the continuing care coordinator. So immediately we are starting to talk about psychoeducation around continuing care, why it's important. You know, the first 90 days in residential is just the first stepping stone of recovery. I also talk about it, what resonates a lot with our clients. I say, listen, you want to have a return on your investment. You've invested all of this money and all of this time and all of these resources, you know, to put into Altamira. I want to make sure that you maintain all of these things. So what with most clients, what we're recommending is a certain amount of what we call step down. So in an ideal scenario, Ezra, a client will come to Altamira, complete the program in 90 days, and if possible, step into what we call a sober living environment. And this is not like a halfway house. These aren't these places that these are very well-established sober livings where clients can actually do that, still living in the same place, but I'm having the exposure of stepping out into these different areas of my life while doing what we call an intensive outpatient program. IOP is, again, maybe 3, 4, 5 days a week that client is continuing to do a certain amount of groups related to their specific issues or addiction to maintain, again, the progress across time. So an ideal scenario, we've got 90 days in residential. They're stepping out with a minimum of 30 days. Sometimes clients stay 90 days in the sober living and the IOP. Then maybe they'll move back home, continue to do the IOP for a few more months. And again, even after that, they're maintaining, whether it's a relationship with a recovery coach, whether they're still doing an accountability measure like SoberLink to assure the family that the client is not drinking.
Yeah, I have a couple of clients that I use SoberLink.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful.
So that's let's explain what it is, because SoberLink is a device that tests that if you're using alcohol or not, correct?
Yes,
only for
absolutely.
Alcohol?
SoberLink is only for alcohol, but you could also do randomized testing for and urine and for a lot of people sort of going to the lab to test for drugs. But what I talk about SoberLink is it's almost more for the family system than it is for the client. The assurance that they have that, you know, they have been through their own traumas. They are hypervigilant. They don't need and shouldn't be the monitor person, the one that's worried. You know, does he seem off or is he anxious or is he angry? Is he using, knowing that that person is blowing into the SoberLink, which is a facial recognition device that the client just very discreetly can blow into 3 times a day, ideally. Those go to hopefully a recovery coach or a case manager. And the family system knows that if they don't hear anything, everything's okay. So they can take that element of worry out of their mind so that they can focus more on their connection, their reestablishing their relationships with the client. I love SoberLink.
So I think we covered most of the things that we wanted to talk.
Okay.
I think it's a great example that a rehab, actually a real rehab or a treatment center in Turkey, we have also that confusion. They separate rehab from the treatment, but actually it's one thing. It's not a place to be scared of. If it's designed well, and if it is addressing all the needs of a client. And you don't need to be a billionaire, you know, it doesn't need to be something like Altamira, but, you know, a place that you can find yourself, refind yourself that you lost many, many years ago. It's almost, you know, almost like a wellness center. Minus, obviously, it's not like you just hang in there without doing anything.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest fear of people is that a rehab sounds really scary because of the movies because of their other experiences that, you know, either they're hospitalized or it looks like a mental institution. But a well-established, well-designed rehab is a place that the person can yet again rebuild their life.
Yeah.
And their psychology, their relationship with their family, and they can be their better self, their best self, actually.
Absolutely. We talk about it. It's a transformative experience. And our clients that leave us, they're always connected to us. We have a really robust alumni program where 4 times a year our clients come back and do mini workshops free of cost and stay connected with each other so the relationships are maintained. And really, we talk about so many clients come back and say, it's hard to put into words what happens if you give yourself the gift of time. The hardest barrier I have with clients is really helping them understand that concept of time. Give yourself this time. If you can afford it and you can take it for that real healing to take place, otherwise you're going to be in these continued loops of use and suffering. And what we want in life is connection and belonging and to thrive and to be healthy and happy. And you can't do those things when you're struggling with addiction. And you can't have that life worth living if you're struggling with all these underlying issues that you've never given yourself an opportunity to address.
Rainey, before closing, if you have one message to the families, not to the person who is in a substance use disorder, what would be that message?
I think the message to the family is that there is hope. I think for many families that there has been so many cycles and years of suffering and fear and anger. And I think that what the message to families is that there are systems of care and treatment that works. What I've done here in my time here and I've realized is it's phenomenal to see when you have access to resources, the transformation that can take place and for their lives to be turned around. So I think my message would be a message of hope that I've seen, I've witnessed it. I've borne witness to the real transformative change that happens and to pass that along to the families.
Rainey, thank you very much. I'm
thank
sure we're
so going
to do another episode in the future.
Okay, I'd love to.
Bye now.
Bye. Thank you.